Today we'll be discussing neurons. Specifically, we'll mostly be addressing, addressing insect neurons, which can be spectacular structures, as is represented in this particular image of a neuron. So, in terms of neurons, we want to ask, how do brain cells or neurons work? And really, you know, that's sort of the crux of our question, because these little neurons enable insects to do amazing behaviors. But it's because they're a network of these neurons that you can actually see how these behaviors work. So how does this network produce behaviors? And we have to ask, what is a synapse? A synapse, you know, how do these neurons communicate? And that's directly how it ties into what a synapse is. So again, these are images of individual insect neurons in the bumblebee brain, as well as the honeybee brain in this particular image. And you can see some very interesting structures there. The basic structure of many insect neurons is usually there's a cell body kind of hanging out over on the side here. And you can see that it's connected by a fine little process to the rest of the cell, which is highlighted here in this lighter color, where the neuron generally has an input and an output region, with the cell bodies located on the side of the neuron. This particular cell is called a unipolar cell type, or the cell body is located as on its own little sort of pole on the side. Whereas the rest of the cell does a lot of the heavy lifting, so to speak. And in terms of input and output, there's the input of the dendrite, which is what is thought to be called the general input region of a neuron. You have the cell body, and then you have what is probably the axon, or the output of the neuron. So there's a flow of information, or this directional flow of information from input to output that goes in the direction of, you know, getting information from, in this case, the area of the optic lobe and going to the central brain. Again, this flow of information is key in terms of neurons to be able to allow information to be communicated from the outside world to the central brain, and from the central brain to the rest of the system. So neurons can clearly come in many different shapes and sizes, and to sort of demonstrate that, these are individual brain cells located in the bumblebee brain. In both cases, you can see the cells are lit up. Here's the cell body sitting on the side here. You can see they have complex input regions and complex processes. In these cases, they're in the lobula of the optic lobes of the bumblebee. Then they also output to certain regions within the brain. And then what we can also do is use specific programs to reconstruct the cells in terms of where their inputs and outputs are, and then be able to, with these reconstructions, examine the actual structure of a brain cell. Because a brain cell really isn't ever flat, unless you throw it in a dish. But even in those cases, it has this complex, amazing, convoluted structure, where when you actually like to take a look at it when it's in the brain, as you rotate it and you do a reconstruction of the cell and then rotate it through, you can see this, you know, complex structure, as you can see from all these different angles, which has to do with how the neuron works to gather information and then process it and then send out information to other brain regions. And really, they can come in many different shapes and sizes. This is only a smattering of some different types, and these are all actually visual neurons that are involved in the processing of visual cues, all in the optic lobes, indicated here, 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 and here. And these are just a few smattering of different types of visual neurons in the honeybee and bumblebee brain. But it can be hugely diverse and even more complex than this in other brain regions. But when it comes to this flow of information, what does that mean? You know, in terms of neurons ranging from nematodes to insects to vertebrates to humans, etc., the neurons generally have to have, you know, generally have a input region and an output region. But what is the input region and output region? Well, that sort of information of input to output is conducted via electrical signals from the input to the output sites. And it's essential in terms of this electrical, you know, signals for the encoding of information and to be able to produce an output signal. And the real question is, how is this done that you can actually get information and then output it? And as information is conducted from the dendrite, the input region, to the axon and outputs via synapses, which is the actual connections between cells, how is this process occurring? Well, one way is that neurons generally can use electrical and chemical cues to communicate. Neurons, like, you know, have a balance of ions across the membrane. By creating different ion concentrations across the membrane using ion pumps, neurons can create what is called an electrochemical gradient. This gradient, that means that some ions have a tendency to move across the membrane when the channels in the membrane are open for that ion. To sort of show, display that in a little more simpler way, there are specific ions, particularly potassium, sodium, chloride, and calcium, symbolized with their elements, that operate as key players in creating this gradient and traveling across the membrane. So if you zoom in on one tiny little section of this cell, what you'll see is that the outside of the cell versus the inside of the cell has a different kind of gradient. Now, what this little sort of zoom in is, more or less just a zoom in on the membrane of a cell. And the cell membrane is generally a phospholipid bilayer populated with tons of different proteins across the cell membrane. Inside the cell, there's a certain number of, you know, concentration ions, but there's lots of proteins inside the cell, and a lot of them are negatively charged, and those are called anions, or negatively charged ions. And they create sort of a negative charge within the cell. But because of pumps or various other reasons, there's different types of charges across the cell membrane. You'll generally see, because of the anions and other reasons, that the cell on the inside is generally more negative, which you can see with these little sort of negative symbols here, whereas the outside of the cell is generally more positive compared to the inside. Another thing you'll notice is, as represented by these larger print sort of concentrations, there's more sodium on the outside versus the inside. There's more potassium on the inside versus the outside. More calcium and chloride on the outside versus the inside, which is again represented by how large these fonts are. And what I would try to indicate with these sort of little boxes are individual proteins that act as the gatekeepers to be able to conduct ions across the cell membrane. So there's a sodium type channels, there's potassium type channels, there's chloride and calcium type channels that allow these ions to move down their concentration gradient, meaning that since there's lots of calcium on the outside of the cell, it would generally, if you open these channels, try to flow inside the cell. Again, with chloride and sodium, whereas with potassium, if its ion channel opened, it would generally try to flow outward. And a big key player in this whole thing to be able to create some of these gradients, particularly with potassium sodium, is the sodium potassium ion pump, which uses ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and uses a phosphate to actually actively pump sodium from inside the cell to outside the cell, while at the same time taking potassium ions and bringing it inside the cell. This pump is a huge key player to be able to create this gradient of chemicals, this chemical gradient across the membrane, which then also can create this electrical gradient across the membrane, hence the electrochemical gradient. But if you guys are interested in sort of examining this further, I would definitely recommend going to this website at St. Andrews, or www.standrewsac.uk, and at this neurotutorial, which actually goes through and demonstrates how the membrane potential could work based on the balance of ions across the membrane. Well, keeping that in mind, and considering that you have this gradient where there's different types of ions, different concentrations, and this electrical imbalance across the membrane. You can then also imagine that when a cell is excited, you can trigger different channels to open or close, or change the activity of these channels to enable ions to move across the cell membrane or not, and thereby which can change the amount of charge inside the cell versus outside. And there's certain channels called voltage-gated channels, which, for example, if you excite them, some of these channels will open and allow more sodium, in this case, to enter, or more potassium to exit. And these are based on changes in voltage across the membrane. So the opening of these specific ion channels can allow these ions to cross the membrane and, in this case, maybe allow sodium to rush into the cell. So by allowing sodium to rush into the cell, you can change the charge on the inside and actually cause the inside of the cell to become more positive than the outside, and thereby, you know, be able to have generalized electrical activity change, such as when you're exciting a cell. And by controlling the concentration of the ions across the cell membrane, you can allow electrical activity to be spread through changes in the charged ion concentrations, or to dissipate or move across the cell, and which is really important for communicating information throughout the cell. So you have to remember, this membrane is all over the cell. And the ions, by shifting around, by opening more channels based on charge, etc., can actually open or close different channels and trigger different types of communication throughout. And a big thing that you need to keep in mind, or at least that a lot of cells can do, is they can allow for this passive spread of ionic changes, which means that ions move slowly through and can allow passive spread of voltage changes. There is another thing called active spread of voltage change, of ionic changes, which involves, or active active voltage changes, which involves a mechanism called action potentials, or spikes. And this particular mechanism of action potentials is a huge key in understanding how neurons can work in general. So imagine you have an amplifier recording the neural activity of a cell. And this amplifier is a tiny little, very fine tip electrode that is able to penetrate the cell membrane and amplify the signal and allow you to record the activity of the cell relative to another reference. And if you record for long enough, for some cells you'll see these gorgeous little spikes. Quite literally, they look like spikes. And in this case, we was able to fill the cell with dye and examine where the cell projects in the nervous system. But with these spikes, you'll see they have a particular shape. They have a very fast increase, can then kind of a slower decrease, and then they kind of, then they kind of go below their original baseline and then level out. This is called the action potential. It was first discovered or best characterized in the squid giant axon, but insects do it, squids do it clearly, and various other animals use it to be able to communicate information from the dendrite through the axon to the synapse, or the output of the cell. And the way that it works is all about this ionic gradient changes. So first, when the cell is excited, the membrane potential moves toward a threshold, which is indicated in this image by this green line, where eventually it reaches threshold where an explosive opening of sodium ion channels allows sodium to rush inside the cell and then pushes it very, very positive toward what we call the equilibrium potential of the cell. Again, I would recommend going to that website and examining, okay, how does that really work on the finer detail. But the end result is this inside of the cell becomes very, very positive, and which is called depolarization and is measured as, you know, and this measurement is called the membrane potential. So the membrane potential itself, in this case, is depolarized, particularly at this point where the sodium channels are open. However, sodium channels then start to close after a certain period of time of 1 to 2 milliseconds. At around the same time that, you know, the sodium channels had been opening, most of the potassium channels are starting to open. And these positive ions, start to exit the cell because they want to go outside the cell because of their concentration gradient or difference. And then because those positive ions are leaving the cell, that causes the cell, you know, membrane potential to decrease and go negative toward what is called the equilibrium potential for potassium. Or it goes into an area called hyperpolarization. So hyperpolarize, or negatively going membrane potential, is triggered by this opening of potassium channels. Eventually, again, the potassium channels close, and the cell returns back to normal, where it was before. So the spike is this explosive opening, and then slightly slower, but not that much slower, closing of potassium, of sodium channels, and then opening and closing of potassium channels, which is hugely key here, is the fact that they're distance in time. So so the cell allows this huge spike to happen and then goes away. And because of various properties of the different channels, this particular action potential, generally action potentials are directional, they go in one way, and this ties in directly to this idea of flow of information. There's from input to output regions, and it all goes in a single direction. But where does it go? Where does this information then eventually wind up? Well, it goes to the synapse, the output region of a cell, which is also the input region of the cell after it. So cells can send the electrical signals between areas within the cell, but to be able to communicate between cells, that's the synapse. The synapse can be, such as a connection, imagine, between this cell, this red cell, and this green cell, or this blue cell. If you zoom into this one little region where the cell sends its input, and then, so the cell is getting its input from sends its output, and then the cell is getting its input from the red cell, you take a close look at it, and you have a synapse where a cell, the presynaptic cell, forms a close association, a very close protein and membrane bound area, called a synapse, with the postsynaptic cell, so pre and post. A synapse can be electrical, where the connection is actually pores across the two membranes, called gap junctions. They form open channels for ions to go directly between cells, so actually acting almost just like a huge network of cells. But more often they're chemical, because you can generally chemical synapses are much more plastic, can be utilized for much more different things, and can be adjusted and fine-tuned in a slightly more tightly controlled way than the electrical synapse. But in this case, chemical cues are sent from one cell, the presynaptic cell, to the postsynaptic cell. And what are these chemical cues? What enables a cell to talk to another cell? Well, I know it's a lot of chemistry here, but each of these molecules here have been associated with as neurotransmitters or neuromodulators. Now, I wanted to highlight specific ones, specifically acetylcholine and GABA, which are hugely important in the central nervous system of the insect, histamine involved in photoreceptors, and then glutamate, which we'll be discussing a little bit later. And then there's another class which involves another set of molecules called neuromodulators. So each of these different classes have specific roles. First, neurotransmitters are generally released at the synaptic cleft, or the area of the synapse between one cell to the next. And they travel from the presynaptic site to bind to receptors at the postsynaptic site to trigger a response in the postsynaptic cell, generally a very fast response. These neurotransmitters can be excitatory, therefore increasing the chance the cell will spike, or inhibitory, thereby decreasing the chance the cell will spike. If you remember a couple slides ago, to be able to get a cell to spike or produce an action potential, you have to, you know, get the cell to increase its membrane potential to threshold, and then it can spike. Well, these different neurotransmitters can decrease that chance or increase that chance to get to threshold. For example, acetylcholine, expressed in most of the central nervous system at different synapses, and it's generally excitatory, as opposed to glutamate, which is the neurotransmitter that is released by motor neurons to communicate with the muscle. So how insects move involves glutamate, and it's generally excitatory, as opposed to gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA. It's expressed all over the central nervous system, and it's generally inhibitory, whereas histamine, on the other hand, it's mostly expressed or released by photoreceptors in the eye and the ocelli and some other areas, but it's inhibitory. So these different neurotransmitters have different sort of effects in the nervous system and generally different roles, which contrasts to the neuromodulators. So neuromodulators are different in that they don't necessarily have to have a fast effect, often they're a slower effect. They can be released at a synapse, around the synapse, or even all over the synapse. They can have a slow effect on the postsynaptic cell and induce long-term changes in the cell through complex second messenger molecular systems, and then even change protein expression patterns in the cell. They can cause the target cells to increase or decrease general activity, change synaptic strength, or change the entire dynamics of a brain network. So each of these roles means that dopamine, for example, can change the activity of cells, you know, actually be involved in certain types of learning in flies and have been associated with arousal and sleep, while another one, like serotonin, has something to do with circadian rhythm. But they can also change what's going on in the cell. Octopamine is not just released widely in the entire system, but it can also change synaptic strength. It can thought to be involved in reward learning, etc. Then there's also a final group which remains, honestly, not that well described, called neuropeptides, which has huge various roles and are generally larger molecules that are peptides that then latch onto specific synapses and have various roles all over the place. But I would definitely go to this website, the Wikipedia website on neuromodulators, to learn a bit more about some of the individual roles of these ions. But the question is still, how does a synapse work? Well, we talked about spikes. And a spike comes down through inside the presynaptic cell. That's how it starts. But as it comes down, it opens up voltage-gated calcium channels. Now, calcium really, in many ways, is somewhat like the magic fairy dust of the cell. It has very many roles, but in this case, as calcium enters the cell, triggered by the spike, it triggers a vesicle fusion of the membrane. So what are vesicles? The vesicles are just basically phospholipid bags which contain these chemicals, these neurotransmitters or neuromodulators, which are constructed by the cell, and they sort of wait in a pool of information. In this pool of area, and it is involved in sort of holding on to your neurotransmitter. But calcium entry then triggers the vesicle fusion, and then the release of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft, which are indicated by these little triangles. So the neurotransmitter moves in through the cleft and binds to postsynaptic receptors. These receptors are proteins which can then bind to the neurotransmitter and then can trigger the opening of ions, or the actual channels in the membrane. So ions such as sodium or potassium can then move across the cell. This can allow positive or negative ions to move across the membrane, which, if positive ions come in, can cause excitatory responses, or in the case of negative ions, inhibitory responses in the postsynaptic cell. So in combination of being able to release the chemical, binding to receptors, and trigger a response, you can see that, you know, there's this series of events that can be very complex in terms of getting a spike to produce a response in the postsynaptic cell from the presynaptic cell. So considering all of these different types of complex ways, there's a hugely important aspect of this whole thing. It's about timing. So the timing and placement of synaptic input makes a huge difference on how the postsynaptic cell could respond. For example, if you trigger a spike in close timing relative to each other, you can have something called spatial or temporal summation. If it's all from one cell, it's called temporal summation, where a spike happened at this arrow and this arrow, and you can see that the response of the postsynaptic cell, which is indicated here, is summated. It actually builds on top of each other. You can also have synapses. Imagine this postsynaptic cell has another synapse from another cell over here nearby. And if that information is both comes at the same time, you can also have spatial summation across many different synapses. But when you have these potentials to these inputs or postsynaptic potentials too far apart, there's no summation. So you're further away from threshold and you can't seem to get the cell to fire and do what you want. There's also the other aspect is that if you add some certain types of potentials together, you'll get cancellation. So add an excitatory and an inhibitory potential together and you'll get no response. So considering this, you can imagine that there's tons of different ways that synaptic inputs can come together to produce a response or to not produce a response in the postsynaptic cell. And of course, you know, we're not just talking about neurotransmitters. So neurotransmitters, as we said before, have a fast sort of trigger, generally. And it can trigger the cell to open up ion channels directly and cause the postsynaptic cell to respond. On the other hand, there are things called neuromodulators, which can be released from the side or directly, or in various different ways from another cell entirely outside of another synapse, such as in this chemical synapse. And in these cases, the neuromodulator can be released to affect the presynaptic cell, the postsynaptic cell, or even just, you know, affect its own partner. And what these neuromodulators do is generally bind to postsynaptic neuromodulatory receptors, which then trigger the second messenger cascade and can enact very different changes within the postsynaptic cell. These kinds of changes could be changes the excitability. If you add more postsynaptic receptors here, you can imagine this synapse would be more amenable to being excited than not. If you add more vesicles, if you add more neurotransmitter to be able to be released each time, you can actually increase the strength of the synapse because it increases the chance that a spike is going to induce another spike in the postsynaptic cell. So there's all sorts of different ways and arrangements where cells can communicate, and neuromodulators induce protein expression and can induce actual genetic changes within the postsynaptic cells to be able to change how cells communicate. So in this case, these binding to receptors of neuromodulators can trigger second messenger pathways, which can lead to learning and memory properties, and so therefore changing the responsiveness to different neuromodulators or neurotransmitters. You can also trigger different behaviors. For example, a really great example of this is if you block, you know, in this case, a particular wasp venom has been used to block octopamine receptors, which is a type of neuromodulator, in the cockroach. And these wasps are basically paralyzing the cockroaches. But the cockroach can still stand. What's great is the wasp can then grab onto their antennae and drag them forward, and the cockroach will actually walk forward with it. something called a zombie cockroach. And I'd recommend going and taking a look at some of these articles or this website, where you see that what this wasp is doing is able to tap into specific neuromodulatory circuits and change how the cockroach moves, but is more or less paralyzed unless the wasp is dragging it forward with its antennae, as if it's more or less riding it. Poor little cockroach. But regardless of the fine-tuned things, we have, you know, of course, the individual cells are great, and they do amazing things, and they have action potentials, and they communicate, etc. The big thing is that neurons operate in a massive network. They're interconnected. They allow insects to live and perform numerous behaviors and operate in many different levels. This is basically almost the entirety of the fruit fly, the vinegar fly brain and thoracic ganglion. Here's the brain, here's the thoracic ganglion, which I'll be discussing in the next lecture. And what you can see is it's complex. It's beautiful, and it has numerous different inputs, and this is where the eyes would be, and it involves various different circuitry. In this case, where we actually stained for serotonin within a flesh fly brain, you can see these neurons are interconnected. There are synapses, there are blebs, there are inputs and outputs, and there's all sorts of axons all over the place. But all this allows the insects to interact with the world around them, and it's then how we look at the network that we can try to understand their behavior.